And here is the 32 account and 32 photos you can keep up with of Mansour Pashtun and the movement. Here's the daily. This was one day's schedule for rallies in different towns at different times. One of the policemen who's accused of being that group that kidnapped Nakibullah, and different documents, different postings, different, what is it? What's going on? Here's the Peshawar rally. Thousands of people. You know, who gets justice? How do you call for it? How do you make a movement for it? So after 1 year, the internationally noticed movement has not faded or been suppressed by authorities. It has attracted support from a variety of political parties and political figures. It has not been co-opted or subordinated to any political party yet, and they refuse to project themselves as a party who's going to run people for office. They're saying, we just want justice. We're apolitical in that sense of party politics. It has been attacked by partisan opponents connected to established political or institutional interests. At the end of 2018, two leading members of the Awami National Party, the Pakhtun Party, the AMP, were expelled from the party, nominally for spending too much time on social media, including supporting the Pashtun Protection Movement. And I don't know if anybody noticed that story, but Bushra Gohar was one of the two who was basically suspended from the party. And one story said they were suspended under pressure from authorities for supporting the nationalists a little too much, or the movement too much. So Pashtun Protection Movement activists have remained nonviolent. They do not call for different forms of disruptive civil disobedience, but they do demand the right to peacefully gather and demonstrate for their demands. The simple act of gathering together in public has cost several of them their lives. Here are more YouTube clips. You can find all kinds of material on the internet. And when Loney is killed one day in a rally, one story says a policeman came up and hit him in the back of the head with the butt of his rifle and broke his neck. Instantly, it was posted. Instantly, there were protests. And this is a picture of Armand Loney, who, one of the senior members of the movement, dead in Lorelei, which is actually one of the Pashtun predominant areas of Balochistan. So security authorities have used a variety of colonial legacy and updated security laws to deter events, deny the entry of individuals to locations for rallies, and they've stopped and searched and harassed activists at will. One response has been coordinated protests, including global protests. And so here is a hashtag PTM worldwide protests, where they organized public gatherings in 38 cities all over the world on the same day, February 5th, 2019. And you can click through all the different cities and locations that held rallies at the same day to protest the killing of Armand Loney. So very interesting, international coordination. So after a year, this movement might be analyzed through different perspectives. First, it is a 21st century social movement in the Arab Spring model. A younger generation, urban, if only urbanized displaced refugees, educated, often from the emerging middle classes, with high expectations for the future, have used social media to mobilize resistance to authoritarian state policies and institutions. I use this book in my social movements class. The Facebook employee in Dubai who sets up, the online reaction to the Egyptian crackdowns and the murder of one of the activists in Egypt. It is a social movement in a Muslim country with a moral compass grounded in many ways in community standards of justice and accountability. Despite some opponents claiming to see the activists as enabling militancy, there seem to be no Islamist elements, idioms, or agendas in the words or actions of members of the movement. Unfortunately, one lesson of previous Arab Spring-style movements from Egypt to Syria has been that the world has watched as state security institutions have crushed such popular activism, often in the name of repressing Islamist activism and terrorism. In such earlier movements, state manipulation and surveillance of broadcast, print, and social media have been ubiquitous. Pro-establishment news commentary and online materials have been used to discredit the Pashtun movement and leadership. Arrests and detentions continue. We will see how the Pashtun Protection Movement negotiates and survives the future. A second perspective on the Pashtun movement, especially for a historian, is to place it within the sequence of modern nonviolent social movements for civil and human rights that have included movements led by Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela. Idioms of protest are familiar. The Pashtun Long March attracted attention, as did Gandhi's Salt March or Martin Luther King's Civil Rights Marches. Demands for the full rights and protections of citizens under the rule of law have long resonated across the world. The books and writings of the American activist Gene Sharp have been long available online for many people to read and study at different times over the recent years of international social movements. His books are there online to read, and I'll have to ask some of the Pashtuns if they've read any of Gene Sharp's work. If the laws and government policies in other countries were changed by these earlier movements, it happened only over years and generations, and there have been no happy endings for any of the societies involved. Still in Pakistan, a historically vibrant human rights commission, an emerging public sphere in civil society, and the recent start to the integration of the federally administered tribal areas and border Pashtuns into a system of civil rights and protections all suggest that progressive change will continue to be an agenda for many. A third perspective on the Pashtun movement is that this nonviolent social movement for political rights and social protection has a direct lineage to the early 20th century Huda Hidmatgar movement of Abdul Ghaffar Khan, the so-called Frontier Gandhi. This earlier promotion of Pashtun identity, culture, and political rights was called separatist and against the colonial state, and then after 1947, against the nation state. Pakistan's nation-building agenda, directed from the capital, has always been suspicious of regional social and political identities and activism. At first in 2018, establishment voices from the center dismissed the current Pashtun protection movement. For different reasons, more recently, some establishment voices have suggested the Pashtun movement demands may need paying attention to a little bit. So whether that's just rhetoric and lip service, we'll find out. From an academic perspective, it is very interesting to live in a moment when the literature about Muslim societies in the post-colonial world may once again evolve and shift. First, there were the studies of post-1945 secular, often socialist, Arab and Asian nationalist movements that often failed. Then, especially after 1979, came studies of Islamic social movements, or perhaps social movements in Islamic societies. Then after 2001 have come the studies of Islamist movements in the various Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Taliban movements of the world. Now here's the Pashtun Protection Movement, an ethno-linguistic community based on social, an ethno-linguistic community-based social movement claiming regional and national civil and human rights for the citizens under the rule of constitutional law. So here's a map of the different ethnic groups in Pakistan and the Pashtun area, a subset of the greater territory of Pakistan, and certainly a minority of the population. Many scholars, including the historian Aisha Jalal, have written about how after the end of British imperial rule in 1947, Pakistan continued to maintain a system of highly centralized political and economic powers held by disproportionately powerful state institutions. Perhaps this is another moment when Pakistan and its 200 million people continue to renegotiate this post-colonial balance of authority and legitimacy. More theoretically, scholars have discussed nominally democratic and constitutional nation-states with political systems that have been manipulated by authoritarian attitudes, often over decades, to legislate emergency security laws for nominally temporary states of exception. In such states, perceived or proclaimed existential threats to the nation-state have justified the suspension of individual rights, the creation of anti-terrorism courts run by security authorities, and laws that have given security forces impunity for actions. In the federally administered tribal areas, the British Indian Frontier Crimes Regulation gave colonial officials and Pashtun collaborators the power to detain or arrest any individual thought to be a threat. Section 37 authorized the killing of any such individual, even one simply suspected of possible future actions. In 2018, officials still defended the need to maintain anti-terrorism courts and the need for such laws as the actions in aid of civil power regulation, which was applied to the federally administered tribal areas in 2011, which allowed the military to operate with different degrees of impunity. So some relevant chronology for this discussion begins in 2014. The Pakistan military began their operation in North Waziristan in June. Various factions were displaced, along with large numbers of refugees. So North Waziristan, South Waziristan. Militant connections to Karachi were disrupted. In December 2014, the Army Public School in Peshawar was attacked, and 150 were killed, including, I think, over 100 students. In his book, Inqilabi Masood, the Pakistani Taliban leader, Mufti Noorwali, the leader of the Karachi Pakistan Taliban from June 2013 to 2015, listed 104 Taliban activists killed by security forces in Karachi after these events. Observers note that many died in extrajudicial killings during 2015. In these years of civil strife in Pakistan, thousands of militants and suspected militants were detained, and many died in custody, even as security forces suffered their own casualties. So there was a civil war going on, and a lot of people were killed. After the completion of the operations in the federally administered tribal areas by Pakistani security forces, perhaps the death of Naqibullah Masood in January 2018 marks a transitional moment, with demands being made for a shift from a state of exception to perhaps a state of accountability. One story circulating is that the police originally detained Naqibullah to extort funds he was rumored to have collected to open a new business. The Pashtun Protection Movement is now asking for justice in this case, for an end to collective judgments about Pashtuns, and essentially an end to the mentality in which a state of exception has justified abuses. A last question arises about the role of social media in the context of such nation-state crises. Benedict Anderson is known for his ideas about the role of print capitalism in shaping language use and imagined communities and the consolidation of new nation-state identities. Pakistan authorities from the earliest days of the country have often controlled the press, radio, and television in various attempts to shape and protect the nation-building project. Observers have noted the recent manipulation of government media advertisements and subsidies to again influence press coverage, including of the 2018 election. Cuts in these subsidies forced hundreds of layoffs in the media. One way to control the press is just starve them out and get rid of hundreds of jobs in the media. Authorities added the Pashtun Protection Movement to the list of topics not to be covered by the media. If print capitalism successfully shaped national identities and perhaps could serve state-building projects, the case is more uncertain about the effects of social media on the outcomes of civil rights movements mobilized from below. International opinion and human rights groups may respond when ethnic minorities face discrimination and citizens claim social and human rights, but perhaps only national parliaments, independent judiciaries, and public dialogue and argument will generate enduring reform and change. Let me close with some words from another Pashtun refugee, one who left his home at a young age, especially at times when his father was in jail for offending authorities. In the late 1920s and 30s, Ghani Khan, the son of Abdul Ghaffar Khan, was sent to Britain and then to America to study, then was sent to Bengal to study at Tagore's Shanti Niketan School in Bengal. He was called home and sent abroad as the politics of the Huda Hidmatgar movement ebbed and flowed. In April 1947, in the Peshawar Valley, he formed the Zalmi Pakhtun movement, the Young Pakhtun movement. One Pakhtun historian quotes him discussing the movement. "The Zalmi Pakhtun only listens to the Pakhtuns. The Zalmi Pakhtun is not a political intrigue, but it is an attempt to awaken the Pakhtuns. It was not a violent group, but it was formed for the defense of the unarmed people," end quote. So Ghani Khan was an artist and a poet. He didn't really get into politics too much. Today he might have an Instagram account and be posting paintings or photos of rallies of the Pashtun Protection Movement. His nephew, Afsanjar Khan, the current leader of the Awami National Party, so far has only a limited presence on social media. And their movement, the AMP party, pretty much was wiped out in the last election here. They only have a couple of seats left. And the PTI won most of the seats in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. So that's my presentation, I guess. And there's a lot of issues raised there. I'd be happy to take a shot at any questions you might have about anything going on.
Great. Well, thank you, first of all. Thank you, Rob, for an extremely rich paper, I think, on a topic that few of us are very well informed on.
Now we are.
Yeah, thanks, Max. Rather than abusing my place at the chair, because I have a number of questions, but I've got Rob for the rest of the day, I'll open it up to the floor. My only request is if you identify yourself before you ask a question. So, floor is yours. Max.
Yeah, this is Max Gross, is my name. The movement is relatively new, but have you observed any evolution in this movement over the last year and a half? Changes?
Well, I think we saw that the first couple of rallies related to the death of Nakibala were just organized kind of ad hoc as a popular response, and they called themselves the Pakhtun Kwame Jirga or something. But then when the activist in Di Han, who had kind of an organization that was very quiet, they hadn't been active in publicly in many ways for a while, they saw an issue and they organized a long march, and then over time they attracted the attention of everybody interested. In Lahore they get the left parties joining them and protesting government restrictions. They get all kinds of other groups joining in, participating, even as individual members. AMP members were actually kicked out for being too close to this other group that might be competition, because Afsanjar's got a son who's going to inherit the family party at some point, and he wants to keep that politics going, I think. So Mansour Pashtun, being very articulate on the dais, has gotten a lot of attention because he's so quick on Twitter. Maybe he's attracted that media, that kind of social media attention. There are other leaders on the platforms when they have these hours-long events, but he's become kind of a focus.
They're avowedly non-political, but we know everything is political. Do you see a tendency toward truly becoming political?
Well, it's very subversive to directly challenge the military.
Yes.
And just that fact of standing up on a stage and saying, in fact, one of their slogans is, the people to blame are the ones in uniform. They just say it straight out. And anybody else says that in Pakistan, and they're in a lot of trouble. And this group has been arrested. When Armand Loney was killed, they had demonstrations. They had 20 people arrested in Islamabad. One of those arrested was a woman who was very active on social media and had her own group. When people protested those arrests, after 30 hours, she was released on the orders of Imran Khan, But the other 19 men who are picked up are, I think, still locked up. So there's different kinds of pressures and things going on. It's very interesting.
I'll let you call him.
Yeah.
Deepa. Hello,
Deepa.
Really fascinating because, you know, right now, of course, Imran Khan is Pashtun, right? Yeah. He's the prime minister. Now, leaving that aside for a second, the narrative of the post-independent Pakistan in recent decades has been that the Pashtuns are much more integrating than, say, the Baluch and so forth. But when you bring back the early 20th century national movements, it shows that clearly there were at least several possible ways for the Pashtuns to go. One in a more nonviolent way, and I think the whole Afghan jihad movement, Mujahideen period, closed out a lot of options for the ethno-linguistic definition rather than a more Islamist definition, right? So, and knowing that history, it seems as if there seems to be a return of some of those dormant sort of tendencies, perhaps, that this movement has kept, which you hint at. But then there's another element.
Well, I can do a half an hour on that right there.
I know, so. But another complicated element is the ongoing Pakistan-Taliban, which is also largely Pashtun-based, but anti the state. So, and then I won't even bring in the Afghan Pashtun, but anyway, just at that first question that I had, do you see that as a kind of a resurgence of the earlier narrative, earlier?
So after 1947, Abdul Ghaffar Khan was thrown in jail for just as many years as he was in jail under the British. And because the government, the center, was afraid that he would lead a breakaway movement for Pakhtunistan, a separate country of Pashtuns from Afghanistan and from Pakistan. And the Afghan government after 1947 was pushing for Pakhtun autonomy and a Pakhtunistan as the politics of Afghanistan to harass Pakistan. And so this whole area, you know, especially after East Pakistan breaks away, it's possible the rest of the country will fall apart. And so the center has always been concerned about ethnic identity politics that might lead to weakening the center. And of course, the center has all the levers of colonial power from the Government of India Act of 1935 still in many ways. And so they don't want to give any of that up. And so, and it's the military and the bureaucracy and the big business, the 22 families that were written about. You know, that group still controls much of the politics of Pakistan. Now, what's interesting about the ANP party, very Peshawar Valley oriented, Mardan, Nowshera, Peshawar, this area. But what the Pashtun Protection Movement comes out of is really this kind of south, you know, the Waziristan area, the tribal agencies that are, you know, they're Pashtuns, but they have their own kind of political economy and their own politics of the Taliban and Afghanistan, and since 2001 especially. And a huge, all the tribal agencies have had the Pakistan Army go in and basically occupy the territories for the first time ever. And they do it the same way. In 2009, the Taliban took over Swat. In 2008, and in 2009, the Pakistan Army moved into Swat, and the way their military operations work is they bring in the artillery, and they shell every village and turn 100% of the population into refugees, and then the army drives up the road, and they occupy it, and they stay there. And then they did it in Peshawar, and then they did it in the Momand Agency. They destroy all the villages, they destroy all the businesses, 100% of the population are refugees, basically, and then the Taliban guys go over to Afghanistan. And so the last ones to get that treatment were North and South Waziristan. And again, the villages are destroyed. Mir and Shah has been rebuilt, but now the military controls the shops and the economic life of it. And there are roadblocks here that all the Pashtuns who have been refugees. So the Pashtun Protection Movement begins in the cities, the towns of the settled districts. Banu and Diai Han, where the refugees have gone, where the younger people are getting educated, where they have access to social media, and